answer on this verse. You'd be glad to know, maybe. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord." And I told you three vital qualifications for being a servant of God. The first one was command. Hosea was under the command of God. It was a difficult command to fulfill for four reasons, but he fulfilled it. Second, I didn't actually give you the word, but we talked about it. I'm splitting it here. The word compassion. Compassion. And when we split it, it helps us to understand what it really means. Passion means a very deep feeling, very strong emotion. Com means together. So you have a very deep feeling together with somebody else. The Greek word that it comes from is the word pathos. In English we get sympathy, which is a very weak word in modern English. It used to be stronger. Modern English would use empathy, which means what sympathy used to mean. Enter into somebody else's feelings. Whether they are feelings of great joy and delight or whether they're feelings of great pain, you enter into it. And that is what Jesus, for instance, does with the leper. When it says he had compassion on the leper, it doesn't mean he felt sorry for him and he sort of stood apart and thought, "Oh, poor guy, look at the state he's in." That's not what compassion means. It means you actually feel what he is feeling. Feel the despair, the loathing of your own body because it's so ugly and disfigured with a disease. Feel the shame of being outcast by society. Jesus entered into his feelings. And that's the way we usually use compassion when we talk about God or Jesus. We talk about him entering into our feelings. But in this case, it's the opposite way around. It's Hosea entering God's feelings. Because of his rejection by his wife and all the heartbreak, etc., Hosea understood how God felt and entered into the heart of God. He had compassion with God. Okay? And that is the second basic requirement to be a servant of God. You need to be under the command of God. You have to have compassion with God. Feel the way God feels. Hate sin the way he hates it. Love the sinner the way he loves them. You share God's heart. But there is a third vital quality that's coming through here. Hosea married Gomer. Now, in a small town, they were both well known. Hosea, because of his father and because of his own name and because they were pretty well the only people with a true stand for the faith and for morality and purity, etc., in a totally degraded society. So they were well known. Gomer was also well known. For a different reason. And she was infamous, whereas they were well known. When Gomer and Hosea got married, it didn't take long before that news spread all over town. They didn't have newspapers, they didn't have television, but they did have gossip. And gossip has always been the most effective way of getting news around anyway. And God uses it on this occasion. And the gossip takes the news of this marriage all till everybody in town knows about it. And you can probably imagine how it was. "Hey, have you heard the latest?" "No, what's the latest?" "It's about Hosea." "Oh, that religious nut. What's he done now?" "Opened a monastery." "Well, not exactly. He's got married." "Married? Hosea? Who's he married?" Some kind of strange freak out of a convent school, I suppose. "Hey, no, you'll never guess who he's married." "Well, come on, tell me, who is he married then?" "Gomer." "Gomer? Hey, you're kidding." wait till I tell the guys. And you know, clack, clack, clack. It was all over. Everybody knew about this marriage. It's called communication. And God is using this to communicate. See, everybody in town knew. Now, to begin with, their sympathies were all with Gomer. She was popular and Hosea was not. And there would be all sorts of speculation. People would talk to her. Hey, well, Gomer, how you doing? I hear you got converted. Me? Who told you that? Well, you're married to Hosea, aren't you? Well, sure, what's that got to do with it? You mean you're not converted? Not me. Hey, don't let that get around. I don't want people to think that. No way, no. I'm still in business. Let them know. And she was. And some of them would say, eh, these religious people are all the same underneath, you know. This, I knew, you know, it's just a facade, just a surface, you know. You get below that, they're all just the same as the rest of us, you know. And yet, as time went by, one or two things would become apparent. One would be this. Hosea was not the same as the rest of them. He had not changed. Because he remained faithful to Gomer. And while he wouldn't advertise the fact, it would become fairly apparent that he loved her. And while to begin with all the sympathy would be with Gomer, because she was popular, after a while, people would begin to wonder, and they would begin to wonder things like this. Gomer is really not being very smart. Because here she's got a guy who really loves her, who has provided a home for her, she's got security and she's got a future, and there is no future in her trade. There wasn't then. They didn't make lots of money and they didn't retire wealthy. And the life of a prostitute is fairly short because they lose her appeal after a while. And she's soon going to be old and nobody's going to want her. Why doesn't she recognize that she's well off with Hosea and just settle down? She's really not being very intelligent. And then people would ask themselves about Hosea, why does he tolerate this? You know, why does he not just get totally frustrated with her and boot her out of the house and never let her back in again? Why is she so cheap and why can't she see what he's doing to him and why does he take this? It's bringing no joy whatever, it just hurts him day after day and he's living with this kind of pain and everybody's laughing at him but he doesn't have to put up with it, does he? So why does he? And when is he going to get rid of her? And what did he even see in her in the first place that he got married to her? He didn't have to. I mean, everybody knew she was cheap, he must have known. If he knew what he was like, why did he lumber himself with a person like that? And this would be the kind of way that people would start to think. Now, as we mentioned earlier, you have to keep in mind three marriages. The marriage of God to Israel. And also the marriage of Jesus to yourself. Because God has married Israel. And he looks to her to be faithful to him. And so he says, you must have no other gods before me. And that doesn't mean, as long as I'm number one, you can have numbers two, three, four, five, that's okay. When he says you must have no other gods before me, there is nothing that you will actually worship in front of my face. And since you can not do anything that God doesn't see, everything you do is in front of his face. So God says to Israel, you're not to have any other gods. I won't tolerate that. You're to be faithful to me. I want that sort of relationship. Or as again I told you, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. But he gives a reason. You're not to have any other gods before me, not to make yourself images to them, you're not to bow down or serve them, because I, the Lord your God, am what? What's that word? Jealous? You sure? Is jealousy not one of the seven deadly sins? Wasn't it? As though there were any sins that are not deadly. If jealousy is one of the seven sins, or sin, is God then guilty of sin? Because this is what he says about himself. He says, I am jealous. Suppose when later on this year I'm in California, I take a walk along the beach, and as I stroll along the beach, I observe the people on the beach, and I choose myself 12 very attractive young women. See, the beach is a convenient place to recognize what you're looking for. So I choose 12 attractive women from the beach, and I invite them to come live with me, and they all arrive at my home in England with their suitcases, and they come trooping into the house. My wife says, who are these? See, and I said, I'm glad you asked that. You see, when I married you 24 years ago, you were young and beautiful and full of energy. But time hasn't really been all that kind to you, has it? I mean, you haven't improved with time, and you don't have quite the same amount of energy that you did have 24 years ago. So I thought we could just use a little more glamour and vitality around the home, so I've invited these 12 to come live with us. That's okay, isn't it? See? And of course, she will smile expansively and say, well, certainly, I'm surprised you waited so long. But why only 12? Why don't you bring 25? Yeah. Somehow, I don't think that would be the reaction. She'd be angry. She'd be jealous. And she'd be right. Because she has a right to expect an exclusive place in my life that will never, ever be threatened by anybody else. I can have any number of friends, any kind of friends, but none that infringe on her rights as my wife. I promised her that when we got married, and she's entitled to it. And if that is threatened, then she will feel jealous, and she's right to. See? Now, girls, suppose you got a proposal this afternoon. See, from the Hulk. You know, and is incredibly well-built, really gorgeous-looking, loaded with money, great fun, you know, and he's got drives in, I don't know, Maserati that will do 190 miles an hour, and, you know, he's real popular, and he says to you, you know, I really, really like you. I would like you to be my Wednesday afternoon wife. And you say, could you define what you mean by Wednesday afternoon wife? And he says, well, you know, Wednesday morning's already catered for, so is Wednesday evening, and all the other 6 days of the week, this little slot in the week's not taken care of, see, Wednesday afternoon. Thought maybe you'd like to be my wife for Wednesday afternoons. How about it? And you might not feel enormously flattered by that, might you? In fact, you might feel somewhat insulted, and you might say to him, you know, I thought that love and marriage was a much more total thing than that. And that really doesn't appeal to me. In fact, I feel insulted by that approach. See, now, this is amazing, but God has made the other approach to you. And he's saying, hey, listen, I love you. And I love you so much that I demand to be the only God in your experience. I don't want to share you with any other God. I will be the only God. And I feel jealous about you. And I want you to know that you have another God And that will affect me, and it will make me feel like a husband who is being betrayed. Now you say, well, you know, I understand all this, but Israel had idols. And I don't. So why are you giving me all this? Let me define an idol for you. An idol is anything that threatens to take God's place, or that does take God's place in your life. It's the thing you worship. But the essence of worship is the word worth. That's where it comes from. It's actually worth-ship contracted. And it's where you set your worth, where you place value. Where do you place value? It's the things you think about when you've got time to think. It's how you spend your money when you've got money to spend. That which you value most. Here are some things that people in the West value most. Money, sport, popularity, sex, marriage, family, entertainment, clothes, jewelry, hobbies like photography or fishing. Anything that, quite frankly, to you is more important or could be more important or threatens to be more important than Jesus Christ is. And sure, when you sit down logically and coldly, you say, well, no, fishing's not more important to me than Jesus Christ, because Jesus will get me to heaven and fishing won't. But you have a free afternoon, what do you do with it? What is really most important to you? And Jesus says, anything that threatens to take my place, or that does take my place, anything, whatever it is an idol. Now, come back to this marriage situation. Here's Hosea, here's Gomer. Hosea loves Gomer every day. Every day, Gomer turns her back on Hosea and goes after idols, her lovers. And Hosea knows, and he's hurt, grievously hurt, time after time after time. The people can see that he's hurting. The people can see that Gomer is cheap. The people say, how long is Hosea going to put up with this? And why did he get stuck with her in the first place? The people say, when is Gomer going to be sensible and turn back to her husband? That's exactly, of course, what God wants them to think, because what they're looking at is a picture of themselves. When they see Hosea and they see his frustration, they see his pain, they see God. They see a little picture of what God is experiencing. When they look at Gomer and they say Gomer is cheap, they're looking at themselves. When they see her setting up business and running after all kinds of other men, that is what they were doing, running after all kinds of other gods. But we miss the whole point if we don't see ourselves in the same picture. And when you see Hosea, you see Jesus. And when you see Gomer, you see yourself. And when you say, Gomer is so cheap, I know. That's the way we are. And when you say, why would Hosea get stuck with a person like that? Why should Jesus get stuck with you? And when you say, how long is Hosea going to put up with it? How long is Jesus going to put up with it? How much do you expect him to put up with? And when you say, but he's hurting so much, I know. He told you, I am a jealous God. I'm not an indifferent God. I haven't insulted you by asking you to be my Wednesday afternoon wife or even my Sunday morning wife. I demand to be your only lover. So this marriage was actually a visual aid that God wanted to use to the people then and to us now. And every time you think about this parallel, remember what you do to Jesus Christ when you turn your back on his love and run after your idols. So you can have all kinds of other relationships and friendships and joys and activities, provided they never threaten the main one. Provided they never threaten the place that he must have in your life and mine. Communication is, of course, vital, and God has many, many ways of communicating. Let me just share a couple of things with you. I was on a plane, two plane rides. I was on one plane. There was a man sitting next to me, and I forget how we got into conversation, but he realized that I was a Christian, and he asked me what I did, and I said, well, I'm a kind of a missionary. And he said, oh man, we don't need no more missionaries. And I said, really? He said, no man, man, the world's been evangelized. I said, oh, I'm glad to know that. I can have a rest then. But please tell me when it happened, because I wasn't aware of it. He said, well, man, you see, our little old church, we're doing kind of nicely these days, and we got ourselves a satellite. It's up there, and it's orbiting the earth. And we broadcasting, man, 24 hours a day, we broadcasting our TV programs to our satellite. And then the satellite beams them back down again to the earth, and you can listen to our broadcast anywhere on the earth. So we don't need no more missionaries, man. It's all done. And I said, that's really most impressive, most encouraging. Could you perhaps tell me how many people in Vietnam own a television set? And he said, no, sir, I really don't know. And I said, okay. Can you tell me whether they actually have television or not in Vietnam? And he said, well, no, sir, I really don't know. I said, well, suppose they do, and a few people actually do own a TV set. How many of them own one that can receive the kind of pictures that you broadcast? Same frequency, same number of lines. Well, that's kind of outside my field, sir. I said, okay. Well, just suppose that there are some people in Vietnam who own a television set, and it's actually the kind that can receive the sort of programs that you broadcast. They probably reach Vietnam about an hour a day. How many of them do you suppose actually have it switched on to your station at that particular hour? And how many of those people do you think understand English spoken with a Georgian accent? We're saying a lot. Another ride on a plane, and there were three seats. There was quite a large gentleman in the window seat, and I was in the aisle seat. And the gentleman in the window seat had a huge black Bible, about twice as big as mine. Very impressive tome. Between the two of us, there was a young lady, a very interesting appearance. Half her hair was bright red, and the other half was lime green. And she had suspended from her nose a paper clip and various small items of office equipment hanging from her ears. And it was all very musical when she turned her head, but you didn't need to get too close or you could get your eyes torn out. And 10 minutes after takeoff, this man took out his large black Bible and opened it. It was so large that half of it fell across her knee. And he pointed to a place on the page. He said, young woman, have you been washed in the blood of the Lamb? I won't tell you what she said. But as communication, it was much more effective than what he said. He never spoke again the whole flight. He turned an interesting shade of pink. A little later on, same young woman was having difficulty finding out how the stereo worked, and she managed to call the stewardess instead of putting the light switch on. And I helped her a little bit with those things. And so she found the channel that she wanted on the stereo, and she started listening to the stereo. And then they brought round that plastic kit that the airlines give you, out of which you're supposed to make a lunch. And when they brought that round, she didn't quite know how to handle this, so I showed her how the kit worked. And we started talking. We talked about several things. And then I said to her, you know, there's a question I just have to ask you. And she said, yeah? I said, it's your hair. See, it has really fascinated me since we got on here. And really, I want to know why it looks like that. Is it, first of all, because you think it's beautiful? Or is it, second, because you're trying to say something? Or third, because you substitute for a stoplight in your spare time? Or fourth, because you were born like that? See? And she laughed, and she said, well, I suppose if I've got to pick one of those, it'd be the second one. I'm trying to say something. So I said, then you're going to help me. In the first place, I haven't understood what you're trying to say, although I recognize it must be very important to go to those lengths. And I would really want to know what you're trying to say. But then, if I wanted to say the same thing, how would I say it? And when she sort of sobered up again, she said, well, if you really want to know, what I'm trying to say is this. I really do not like the mess that your generation has made of my world. See? And I said, isn't it amazing how similar we are? Because I don't like the mess my generation's made of the world either. I really don't. And I agree with you 100%. It's one thing, however, to recognize the mess. It's another thing to be able to clean it up. And I suspect that your real problem is that you're not radical enough. And she said, not radical enough? What do you want me to do? Put a blue stripe down the middle? I said, no, I really don't think that's going to do it. See, if you really want to see a better world, and we both agreed that we want to, you can only have a better world if you have better people. But changing the color of their hair won't make them better people. If you really want better people, you've got to start inside. And you've got to make them entirely new inside. And she said, but how can you do that? And I sort of led her off into one or two other discussions, but she kept bringing me back and she said, hey, come on, I want to know. How can you make people new inside? I said, well, you're not really interested in knowing that unless you want to be new inside. And the main objection is that everyone recognizes everybody else needs to be made new inside, but they don't see that they need to be made new inside. See? And if we're going to be serious about this, then we've got to talk about how to make you real inside, but I don't know whether you want that. I think you may be more interested in decorating the outside. See? And she said, well, no, I would really like to be new inside because I know I haven't got the answers. And while I recognize that your generation has made a mess of things, I don't see that mine's really going to be any better. And I said, you really want to be new inside? And she said, yeah, I do. How do you do it? I said, you're going to hate me when I tell you. In fact, you won't even believe me. She said, well, come on, how do I get made new inside? I said, it's what that man said. And she said, it couldn't be. And it was, you see. What he said was absolutely right. Absolutely right. The way he said it was absolutely wrong. Communication is not what we say. Communication is what the other person understands. And that man wanted to talk about a brand new experience in Jesus Christ. What he communicated was he was some kind of religious nut with a big black book. Communication is what our world is understanding. And we desperately need God's ability to communicate to our own times and to our own generation. And he has got so many different ways of doing it. He's very original, very creative. And he wants to use you to communicate, and I don't know how. And I wouldn't begin to presume to tell you how he wants to use you. But I know he wants to use you to get his truth across. In Hosea's case, he used a marriage with a prostitute to mix in a little bit of the other lecture. In Elizabeth's case, he used 65 years of barrenness. And in Mary's case, he used a virgin birth. I don't imagine that he will do any of those three with you. He doesn't have to repeat himself. If you make a study of the way God communicates through the prophets, they've got all kinds of incredibly different techniques. Some of them highly dramatic. Very original, very colorful, but very, very effective. On the day of Pentecost, 3,000 people were converted. But more than that, more than 3,000 said, hey, what's going on here? All these men are Galileans, but we hear them speaking the wonderful works of God in our own particular dialect. And what happened on the day of Pentecost at that point was a miracle of communication. I don't want to discuss the gift of tongues, etc., etc. I don't think this is it in this case. I believe sincerely that there is one, but I don't think this is it. The day of Pentecost was a unique experience in the life of the apostles when God enabled them to communicate. It was symbolic of the coming of the Spirit of God to live within them, to make them His church. And one aspect of the Spirit would be the wind, one aspect would be the fire, the other one would be the ability to communicate. And God has given to His people in the Holy Spirit a way of communicating to our times. And God can enable you to get through in a way which will make sense to the most unlikely people. Now, I don't want to give the impression that I do this all the time. This is the only time that this has ever happened to me. But that young woman on the plane gave her life to Christ. It's the only time I've ever led anybody to Christ on a plane. But she did. I won't tell you what I thought about her when I sat next to her. You know, but I didn't see her as a likely candidate for my first soul won to Christ in an aircraft. I thought the likelihood would be that I would get the sleep that I wanted. Even tried to convince myself that I needed. And I didn't think we'd communicate at all. But God is beautifully fresh and original. He's the author of the human tongue and the human ear and every language, and He can enable you to get through. So this is God's visual aid. And then the children that are born are also visual aids. The first one, Jezreel, or God sows. It was a special type of communication. This was a well-known marriage in the town. Everybody knew Gom was expecting a baby. The baby was born, everybody knew what the baby was called. Let me show you what sort of a thing it is. Suppose that now Dr. Billy Graham and his wife, Ruth Graham, have a baby. See, it's not very likely because Ruth will be certainly over 60. Suppose they have a baby, it will be national news. They would be interviewed by some kind of newscaster or maybe somebody like Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. And this would be big news. And the camera zooms in on the interviewer, on Johnny Carson and Billy Graham. And Johnny puts a program to question to Billy Graham. And he says, "What are you going to call this amazing baby?" And then the camera zooms right in and all you see is Billy Graham's face. And he looks right at the eye and he says, "His name is Watergate." That would make some kind of an impact on American society. They would recognize that name, and it would not be a nice name. It would be an unpopular name. And Mr. Carson would say, "Yuck, why are you going to call him Watergate? What an unusual name." And Billy says, "Because American politics are full of graft and lies and hypocrisy. It became public knowledge at Watergate, but you never dealt with it. And God is saying, I remember it. And you better deal with it and deal with it fast or I will." See? Now, that's not necessarily what I believe about Watergate. I'm just using that as a kind of an illustration. But Jezreel was a very, very ugly incident in the history of the nation. And he says, verse 4, "Then the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel." What was the massacre at Jezreel? Jezreel is a valley, very fertile valley. That's why it's called God Sows. Call him Jezreel. What happened there? Jehu came to power after Ahab had been killed in the battle. Jehu murdered his wife Jezebel. It's a very nice story if you want to read it. She was eaten alive, she was eaten up rather, by the poodles and Pekingeses of the town after she'd been murdered. And Ahab the king had 70 sons. See? And a few supporters. He'd been a busy man during his lifetime. And so he had 70 sons. And any one of them, of course, was a natural heir to the throne, which Jehu wanted. And all these sons were being brought up by different families in Jezreel, because Ahab was too busy to bring up 70 sons himself. So Jehu comes and he sends a message to all these guys that are bringing up the 70 sons, and he says, "Choose whichever one you like, proclaim him king, and then get ready to fight, because I want the throne." And they said, "But we don't want to fight because you'll win. And we don't fancy the odds, so we're not going to make any of them kings. We'll do whatever you say." And so he says, "Well, if you're really going to do whatever I say, this is what I say. Collect the heads of the 70 sons. Never mind the rest, be too heavy. Just bring the heads and bring them to the gate of the city tomorrow morning. And pile them up in two heaps, one on either side of the city gate, because I want to play bowls." No. Just bring the heads. And then I'll know that you really are on my side. See? So they did that, and they made two heaps of 35 heads either side of the city gates. And then Jehu arrived, and he said, you'd better be the judges. It's true that I killed Jezebel. But whoever killed all these? Well, me. Now you better know that the line of Ahab is finished, and I'm going to be king. And Jehu seized the throne that way, and then he went on the rampage, and he killed thousands. Anybody who was either related to Ahab, or had been in Ahab's government, or had been a friend of Ahab, or been a priest under Ahab, anybody. And he just butchered the lot. And Jehu was still on the throne, at least he wasn't, but his dynasty was. I believe you say dynasty over here. That might confuse you with something else. Anyway, the dynasty of Jehu was still there. The house of Jehu still held power. Israel had never repented. They had never dealt with this. They were still living the same sort of way that they were under Ahab and that they began to under Jehu. And God is saying, look, I've had enough. Call him Jezreel. God plants. Because I am now going to avenge the blood of Jezreel. Going to break Israel's military strength. Break the bow of Israel. Here's a reference you should note down. Romans 2, verses 4 and 5. Don't be misled into thinking that God's long-suffering is weakness. It's not. His forbearance with you is designed to lead you to repentance. If you take it as weakness, the fact that he's not stomped on you yet, and you assume that therefore he never will, then all you do is storing up wrath against yourself. Like this, you see. God is not a big mean God sitting up in heaven examining everybody through a pair of binoculars. See? And then suddenly he points to an angel and he says, look, you see that man? He swore. Push him under a bus. See? God doesn't do that. He's not like that. He is slow to anger and plenteous in mercy. That doesn't mean to say he does not get angry, but he doesn't get angry quickly. He's not touchy. He's not irritable. He's not bad-tempered. He is slow to anger. He does get angry. But if you presume on that, because he didn't push me under a bus last time when I swore, that means I can swear again, and that means I can swear for the rest of my life, and God will never do anything. Not necessarily true. He says, I am going to bury Israel, and he does. I told you a little bit of the geography. Is Israel, is Judah, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon. Within Hosea's lifetime, Assyria came. Probably the cruelest army, apart from that of Genghis Khan, in the history of the world. Extremely cruel. When they captured a city, this is one thing that they enjoyed doing. They looked for all the women who are expecting babies. And they brought them with their husbands to the city walls. And they got them on top of the city walls, and they took a sword and they slashed open the woman. They took the baby and threw it over the wall so it plummeted down and spattered on the rocks at the foot of the wall. And they forced the husband to watch that happening. They left the wife to die, and they burned out the eyes of the husband, so that the last thing he saw while he had vision was what happened to his wife, what happened to his baby. That was the army that in the year 721 conquered Israel. Israel's never been a nation since. God says, I'm going to plow up the ground and bury them, God's souls. And the 10 tribes of Israel disappeared at that time, many of them taken away as slaves into Assyria, others, of course, killed, very high proportion killed, and they disappeared from view. They must be around somewhere, but nobody knows where. See? Those are the people that received originally the 10 commandments, the nation that was brought out of slavery from Egypt across the Red Sea, nation that had all the prophets, the nation that insisted on committing spiritual adultery, and God removed his protection. Assyria moved in, and that's history. Don't let the long-suffering of God lead you to believe that you can fool around with sin indefinitely and go on getting away with it. It's not true. Father, we thank you for this rather graphic lesson. Thank you for the very vivid communication of the marriage of Hosea and Gomer. Thank you that it does speak loudly and clearly to us today.